Chapter 36. Only someone who has barely a week left to live could waste his time the way I wasted mine during those days. All I did was watch over the telephone and gnaw at my soul, so much a prisoner of my own blindness that I wasn't even capable of guessing what destiny had in store for me. On Monday at noon, I went over to the literature department in Plaza Universitat, hoping to see Bea. I knew she wouldn't be amused if I turned up there and we were seen together, but facing her anger was preferable to continuing with that uncertainty. I asked in the office for Professor Belasquez's lecture room and decided to wait for the students to come out. I waited for about 20 minutes until the doors were opened and I saw the arrogant, well-groomed countenance of Professor Belasquez, as usual surrounded by his small group of female admirers. 5 minutes later, there was still no sign of Bea. I decided to walk up to the door of the lecture room and take a look. A trio of girls were huddled together, like a Sunday school group, chatting and exchanging either lecture notes or secrets. The one who seemed to be the leader of the congregation noticed my presence and interrupted her monologue to fire me an inquisitive look.
I'm looking for Beatriz Aguilar. Do you know whether she comes to this class?
The girls traded venomous glances.
Are you her fiancé? One of them asked. The officer?
I smiled blankly, and they took this to mean yes. Only the third girl smiled back at me shyly, averting her eyes. The other two were more forward, almost defiant.
I imagined you different, said the one who seemed to be the head commando. "Where's the uniform?"
asked the second-in-command, observing me with suspicion.
"I'm on leave. Do you know whether she's already left?" "Beatrice didn't come to class today,"
the chief informed me.
"Oh, didn't she?"
"No," confirmed the suspicious lieutenant.
"If you're her fiancé, you should know that."
"I'm her fiancé, not a civil guard."
"Come on, let's go. The boy's an idiot,"
the chief said. They both walked past me, eyeing me sideways with disdain. The third one lagged behind. She stopped for a moment before leaving and, making quite sure the others didn't see her, whispered in my ear,
"Beatriz didn't come on Friday either."
"Do you know why?"
"You're not her fiancé, are you?"
"No, only a friend."
"I think she's ill."
"Ill?"
"That's what one of the girls who phoned her said. I must go."
Before I was able to thank her for her help, the girl went off to join the other two, who were waiting for her with withering looks at the far end of the cloister.
"Daniel, something must have happened. A great aunt has died, or a parrot has got the mumps, or she's caught a cold from so much going around without enough clothes to cover her backside. Goodness knows what. Contrary to what you believe, the earth does not revolve around the desires of your crotch."
"You think I'm not aware of that? You don't seem to know me, Fermin."
"My dear, if God had wished to give me wider hips, I might even have given birth to you. That's how well I know you. Pay attention to me. Throw off these morbid thoughts and get some fresh air. Waiting is the rust of the soul."
"So I seem absurd to you?"
"No, you seem fretful. I know that at your age these things look like the end of the world, but everything has a limit. Tonight you and I are going on a binge to a club on Calle Plateria. Apparently it's all the rage. I hear there are some new Scandinavian girls straight from Ciudad Real who are real knockouts. It's on me."
"And what will Bernarda say?"
"The girls are for you. I'll be waiting in the hall, reading a magazine and looking at the nice merchandise from afar, because I'm a convert to monogamy. If not in mentis, at least de facto."
"I'm very grateful, Fermin, but..."
"A young boy of 18 who refuses such an offer is not in his right mind. Something must be done immediately. Here."
He searched in his pockets and handed me some coins. I wondered whether these were doubloons with which he was going to finance the visit to the sumptuous seraglio of Iberian nymphs. "We won't get far with this, Fermin. You're one of those people who fall off a tree and never quite reach the ground.
Do you really think that I'm going to take you to a whorehouse and bring you back, covered with gonorrhea, to your dear father, who is the saintliest man I've ever met? I told you about the girls to see whether you'd react, appealing to the only part of your person that seems to be in working order. The coins are for you to go to the telephone on the corner and call your beloved, with a bit of privacy. Bea told me quite clearly not to phone her. She also told you she'd call you on Friday. It's already Monday. It's up to you. It is one thing to believe in women and another to believe what they say. Convinced by his arguments, I slipped out of the bookshop, walked over to the public telephone on the street corner, and dialed the Aguilar's number. At the fifth ring, someone lifted the telephone on the other end and listened in silence, without answering. 5 eternal seconds went by. "Bea," I murmured, "is that you?" The voice that answered struck my stomach like a hammer.
"You son of a bitch. I swear I'm going to beat your brains out."
It was the steely tone of pure contained anger, icy and serene. That is what scared me most. I could picture Señor Aguilar holding the telephone in the entrance hall of his apartment, the same one I had often used to call my father and tell him I would be late because I'd spent the afternoon with Tomás. I stayed where I was, listening to Bea's father breathing, dumb, wondering whether he'd recognized my voice.
"I see you don't even have the balls to talk, you bastard. Any little shit is capable of doing what you've done, but at least a man would have the guts to show his face. I would die of shame if I thought that a 17-year-old girl had more balls than me, because she hasn't told me your name and she's not going to. I know her. And since you don't have the courage to show your face for Beatrice's sake, she's going to have to pay for what you've done."
When I hung up, my hands were shaking. I wasn't conscious of what I'd done until I left the telephone box and dragged myself back to the bookshop. I hadn't stopped to consider that my call would only make things worse for Bea. My only concern had been to remain anonymous and hide my face, disowning the person I professed to love and whom I had only used. I had done this before when Inspector Fumero had beaten up Fermin. I had done it again when I'd abandoned Bea to her fate. I would do it again as soon as circumstances provided me with another opportunity. I stayed out in the street for 10 minutes, trying to calm down before returning to the bookshop. Perhaps I should call again and tell Señor Aguilar that yes, it was me, that I was crazy about his daughter, end of story. If he then felt like coming by in his general's uniform and beating me up, he had every right to do so. I was on my way back when I noticed that somebody was watching me from a doorway on the other side of the street. At first I thought it was Don Federico, the watchmaker. But a quick glance was enough to make me realize this was a taller, more solid-looking individual. I stopped to return his gaze, and to my surprise he nodded, as if he wished to greet me and prove that he didn't mind at all that I'd noticed his presence. The light from one of the street lamps fell on his face. His features seemed familiar. He took a step forward, buttoning his raincoat to his neck, then smiled at me and walked away towards the Ramblers, mingling with other passers-by. It was only then I recognized him, the police officer who had held me down while Inspector Fumero attacked Fermin. When I entered the bookshop, Fermin looked at me inquisitively.
"What's that face for?"
"Fermin, I think we have a problem." That same evening, we put into action the plan we had conceived with Don Gustavo Barceló.
"The first thing is to make sure that you are right about us being under police surveillance. We'll walk over to El Catregats, casually, to see whether that man is still out there lying in wait, but not a word of this to your father, or you'll end up with a kidney stone."
"And what do I tell him? He's suspicious enough as it is."
"Tell him you're going out to buy sunflower seeds or something."
And why do we need to go to Els Quatre Gats, precisely? Because they serve the best ham sandwiches in a 3-mile radius, and we have to talk somewhere. Don't be a wet blanket. Do as I say, Daniel.
Welcoming any activity that would distract me from my thoughts, I obeyed meekly, and a couple of minutes later was on my way out into the street, having assured my father that I'd be back in time for dinner. Fermin was waiting for me on the corner. As soon as I joined him, he raised his eyebrows to indicate that I should start walking.
"We've got the rattlesnake about 20 yards behind us. Don't turn your head."
"Is it the same one?"
"I don't think so, unless he's shrunk with all this wet weather. This one looks like a novice. He's carrying a sports page that's 6 days old. Fumero must be recruiting apprentices from the charity hospice."
When we got to Els Quatre Gats, our plainclothes policeman sat at a table a few yards from ours and pretended to reread last week's Football League report. Every 20 seconds he would throw us a furtive glance.
"Poor thing, look how he's sweating," said Fermin, shaking his head. "You seem rather distant, Daniel. Did you speak to the girl or didn't you?"
Her father answered the phone.
"And you had a friendly and civil conversation?"
"It was more of a monologue."
"I see. Must I therefore infer that you can't address him as Papa yet?"
"He told me verbatim that he was going to beat my brains out."
"Surely that was a rhetorical flourish."
At that moment, the waiter's frame hovered over us. Fermin asked for enough food to feed a regiment, rubbing his hands with anticipation.
"And do you want anything, Daniel?"
I shook my head.
When the waiter returned with two trays full of tapas, sandwiches and various glasses of beer, Fermin handed him a handsome sum and told him to keep the change.
"Listen, boss," he added, "do you see that man sitting at the table by the window, the one dressed like Jiminy Cricket, with his head buried in his newspaper, as if it were a cone?"
The waiter nodded with an air of complicity.
"Could you please go and tell him that there's an urgent message from Inspector Fumero? He must go immediately to the Boqueria market to buy 20 duros worth of boiled chickpeas and take them without delay to police headquarters in a taxi if necessary. Or he must prepare to present his balls to him on a plate. Would you like to repeat it?"
"That won't be necessary, sir. 20 duros worth of chickpeas or his balls on a plate."
Fermin handed him another coin. "God bless you."
The waiter nodded respectfully and set off towards our pursuer's table to deliver the message. When he heard the instructions, the watchman's face dropped. He remained at the table for another 15 seconds, torn, and then galloped off into the street. Fermin didn't bat an eyelid. In other circumstances, I would have enjoyed the episode, but that night I was unable to get Bayer out of my mind.
"Daniel, come down from the clouds. We have work to discuss. Tomorrow, without delay, you must go and visit Nuria Monfort, as we planned."
"And when I'm there, what do I say to her?"
"You'll think of something. The plan is to follow Signor Barthelot's very sensible suggestion. Make her aware that you know that she lied to you about Carax, that her so-called husband, Michael Molinaire, is not in prison as she pretends, that you've discovered that she is the evil hand responsible for collecting the mail from the old Fortuny Carrick's family apartment, using a P.O. box in the name of a non-existent solicitor's firm. You tell her whatever is necessary to light a fire under her feet, then, just for effect, you leave her to stew for a while in her own juices.
And in the meantime..."
"In the meantime, I'll be waiting to follow her, an objective I plan to put into practice using the latest techniques in camouflage."
"It's not going to work, Fermin."
"Oh, ye of little faith, come on. What did this girl's father say to get you into this frame of mind? Is it the threat you're worried about? Don't pay any attention to him. Let's see, what did the lunatic say?"
I answered without thinking.
"The truth." "The truth according to St. Daniel the Martyr?
You can laugh as much as you like. It serves me right."
"I'm not laughing, Daniel. It's just that I feel bad seeing you punish yourself. Anyone would think you're about to put on a hair shirt. You haven't done anything wrong. Life has enough torturers as it is, without you going around moonlighting as a grand inquisitor against yourself."
"Do you speak from experience?" Fermin shrugged.
"You never told me how you came across Fumero," I said.
Would you like to hear a story with a moral?
Only if you want to tell it.
Fermin poured himself a glass of beer and swigged it down in one gulp.
Amen, he said to himself.
What I can tell you about Fumero is common knowledge. The first time I heard him mentioned, the future inspector was a gunman working for the anarchist syndicate, the FAI. He had earned himself quite a reputation because he had no fear and no scruples. All he needed was someone's name and he'd finish him off in the street with a shot to the face in broad daylight. Such talents are greatly valued in times of unrest. The things he didn't have were loyalty or beliefs. He didn't give a damn what cause he was serving as long as the cause would help him climb the ladder. There are plenty of scum like him in the world, but few of them have Fumero's talent. From the anarchists, he went on to serve the communists, and from there to the fascists was only a step. He spied and sold information from one faction to another, and he took money from all of them. I'd had my eye on him for a long time. I was working for the government of the Generalitat at the time. Sometimes I was mistaken for the ugly brother of President Companys, who would fill me with pride.
What did you do?
A bit of everything. In today's radio soaps, it would be called espionage. But in wartime, everyone is a spy. Part of my job was to keep an eye on types like Fumero, as they're the most dangerous. They're like vipers with no creed and no conscience. In a war, they appear everywhere. In times of peace, they put on their masks. But they're still there. Thousands of them. The fact is that sooner or later I discovered what his game was. Rather later than sooner, I'd say. Barcelona fell in a matter of days, and now the boot was on the other foot. I became a persecuted criminal, and my superiors were forced to hide like rats. Naturally, Fumero was already in charge of the clean-up operation. The purge was carried out openly, with shootings in the streets, or in Montjuic Castle. I was arrested in the port while attempting to obtain passage to France on a Greek cargo ship with some of my superiors. I was taken to Montjuic and held for 2 days in a pitch-dark cell with no water or ventilation. The next light I saw was the flame of a welding torch. Fumero and a man who only spoke German had me hung upside down by my feet. The German first got rid of my clothes by burning them with a torch. It seemed to me that he was well practiced. When I was left stark naked with all the hairs on my body singed, Fumero told me that if I didn't tell him where my superiors were hiding, the fun would begin in earnest. I'm not a brave man, Daniel. I never have been. But what little courage I possessed, I used to tell him to go screw himself. At a sign from Fumero, the German injected something into my thigh and waited a few minutes. And while Fumero smoked and watched me, smiling, he began to roast me thoroughly with the welding torch. You've seen the marks?
I nodded.
Fermin spoke in a calm tone with no emotion.
These marks are the least important. The worst scars remain inside. I withstood the torch for an hour, or perhaps it was just 1 minute, I don't know. But I ended up giving them the first names, surnames, and even the shirt sizes of all my superiors, and even those who were not. They abandoned me in an alleyway in Pueblo Seco, naked and with my skin burned. A good woman took me into her home and looked after me for 2 months. The communists had shot her husband and her 2 sons dead on her doorstep. She didn't know why. When I was able to get up and go out to the street, I learned that all my superiors had been arrested and executed just hours after I had informed on them.
Fermin, if you don't want to tell me all this...
No, I'd rather you heard it and knew who you're dealing with.
When I returned to my home, I was told it had been expropriated by the government, with all my possessions. Without knowing it, I had become a beggar. I tried to get work. I was rejected. The only thing I could get was a bottle of cheap wine for a few centimos. It's a slow poison that burns your guts like acid, but I hoped that sooner or later it would work. I told myself I would return to Cuba one day, to my mulatto girl. I was arrested when I tried to board a freighter going to Havana. I've forgotten how long I spent in prison. After the first year, you begin to lose everything, even your mind. When I came out, I began to live on the streets, where you found me an eternity later. There were many others like me, colleagues from prison or parole. The lucky ones had somebody they could count on outside, somebody or something they could go back to. The rest of us joined the army of the dispossessed. Once you're given a card for that club, you never stop being a member. Most of us only came out at night, when the world wasn't looking. I met many others like me. Rarely did I see them again. Life in the streets is short. People look at you in disgust, even the ones who give you alms. But that is nothing compared to the revulsion you feel for yourself. It's like being trapped in a walking corpse, a corpse that's hungry, stinks, and refuses to die. Now and then, Fumero and his men would arrest me and accuse me of some absurd theft or of pestering girls on their way out of a convent school. Another month, in La Modelo prison, more beatings, and out onto the street again. I never understood the point of those farces. Apparently the police thought it convenient to have a census of suspects at their disposal, which they could resort to whenever necessary. In one of my meetings with Fumero, who by now was quite the respectable figure, I asked him why he hadn't killed me, as he'd killed the others. He laughed and told me there were worse things than death. He never killed an informer, he said. He let him rot alive. Fermin, you're not an informer. Anyone in your place would have done the same. You're my best friend. I don't deserve your friendship, Daniel. You and your father saved my life. My life belongs to you both. Whatever I can do for you, I will. The day you got me off the streets, Fermin Romero de Torres was born again. That's not your real name, is it? Fermin shook his head. I saw that one on a poster at the Arenas bullring. The other is buried. The man who used to live within these bones died, Daniel. Sometimes he comes back in nightmares. But you've shown me how to be another man. And you've given me a reason for living once more. My Bernarda. Fermin. Don't say anything, Daniel. Just forgive me, if you can. I embraced him without a word and let him cry. People were giving us strange looks, and I returned their looks with venom. After a while, they decided to ignore us. Later, while I walked with Fermin to his pension, my friend recovered his voice. What I've told you today, I beg you not to tell Bernarda. I won't tell Bernarda or anyone else, not a word, Fermin. We said farewell with a handshake. Chapter 37. I couldn't sleep at all that night. I lay on my bed with the light on, staring at my smart Mont Blanc pen, which hadn't written anything for years. It was fast becoming the best pair of gloves ever given to someone with no hands. More than once, I felt tempted to go over to the Aguilars' apartment and, for want of a better outcome, give myself up. but after much meditation I decided that bursting into Bayer's home in the early hours of the morning was not going to improve matters. By daybreak, exhausted and confused, I had concluded that the best thing to do was let the water flow. In time, the river would carry the bad blood away. The morning inched by with little activity in the bookshop, and I took advantage of the circumstance to doze, standing up, with what my father described as the grace and balance of a flamingo. At lunchtime, as arranged with Fermin the night before, I pretended I was going out for a walk, while Fermin claimed he had an appointment at the outpatients department to have a few stitches removed. As far as I could tell, my father swallowed both lies whole. The idea of systematically lying to my father was beginning to unnerve me, and I said as much to Fermin halfway through the morning while my father was out on an errand. "Daniel, the father-son relationship is based on thousands of little white lies. Presents from the Three Kings, the Tooth Fairy, meritocracy, and many others. This is just one more. Don't feel guilty." When the time came, I lied again and made my way to the home of Nuria Montfort, whose touch and smell remained indelible in my memory. The cobblestones of Plaza de San Felipe Neri had been taken over by a flock of pigeons, but otherwise the square was deserted. I crossed the paving under the watchful eye of dozens of pigeons and looked around in vain for Fermin, disguised as heaven knows what. He had refused to reveal his plan. I went into the building and saw that the name of Michel Molinaire was still on the letterbox. I wondered whether that would be the first flaw I was going to point out in Nuria Montfort's story. As I went up the stairs in the dark, I almost hoped she wouldn't be at home. Nobody can feel more compassion for a fibber than another one. When I reached the fourth floor landing, I stopped to gather my courage and devise some excuse with which to justify my visit. The neighbour's radio was still thundering at the other end of the landing, this time broadcasting a game show on which contestants tested their knowledge of religious lore. It went by the name With a Little Help from the Lord, and reputedly held the whole of Spain spellbound every Tuesday at noon. "And now for 5 points, and with a little help from the Lord, can you tell us, Bartolomé, how does the evil one disguise his appearance in front of the wise men of the tabernacle in the parable of the archangel and the gourd in the book of Joshua? A, as a young goat, B, as a jug vendor, or C, as an acrobat with a monkey?" Riding on the wave of applause from the audience in the studios of Radio Nacional, I planted myself in front of Nuria Montfort's door and pressed the bell for a few seconds. I listened to the echo spread through the apartment and heaved a sigh of relief. I was about to leave when I heard footsteps coming to the door. The peephole lit up like a tear of light. I smiled. As the key turned in the lock, I breathed deeply. Chapter 38.
Daniel.
The blue smoke of her cigarette coiled around her face. Her lips shone with dark lipstick. They were moist and left marks like bloodstains on the filter she'd held between her index and ring fingers. There are people you remember and people you dream of. For me, Nuria Montfort was like a mirage. You don't question its veracity, you simply follow it until it vanishes or until it destroys you. I followed her through to the narrow, shadowy room that contained her desk, her books, and that collection of lined-up pencils, like an accident of symmetry.
"I thought I wouldn't see you again."
"I'm sorry to disappoint you." She sat on the chair by her desk, crossing her legs and leaning backwards. I tore my eyes away from her throat and concentrated on a damp spot on the wall. I went up to the window and had a quick glance around the square. No sign of Fermin. I could hear Nuria Montfort breathing behind my back, could feel her eyes brushing my neck. I spoke without taking my eyes off the window. A few days ago, a good friend of mine discovered that the property manager responsible for the old Fortuny Carrick's apartment had been sending his correspondence to a P.O. box in the name of a firm of solicitors which apparently doesn't exist. This same friend discovered that the person who for years has been collecting the mail to this P.O. box has been using your name, Signora Montfort.
Shut up!
I turned around and saw her retreating into the shadows.
You judge me without knowing me, she said.
Then help me to get to know you.
Have you told anyone about this? Who else knows what you've just said to me?
More people than you'd think. The police have been following me for a long time.
Fumero!
I nodded. It seemed to me that her hands were trembling.
You don't know what you've done, Daniel.
Then tell me, I answered with a harshness I didn't feel.
You think that because you chance upon a book, you have a right to enter the lives of people you don't know and meddle in things you cannot understand and that don't belong to you.
They belong to me now, whether I like it or not.
You don't know what you're saying.
I was in the Aldaya's house. I know that Jorge Aldaya is hiding there. I know he was the person who murdered Carrax. I didn't know that I believed these words until I heard myself saying them. She looked at me for a long time, choosing her words carefully.
Does Fumero know this?
I don't know.
You'd better know. Did Fumero follow you to that house?
The anger in her eyes burnt me. I had made my entrance playing the role of accuser and judge, but with every minute that passed, I felt more like the culprit.
I don't think so. Did you know? Did you know that it was Aldaya who killed Julian, and that he's hiding in that house? Why didn't you tell me?
She smiled bitterly.
You don't understand anything, do you? I understand that you lied in order to defend the man who murdered the person you call your friend, that you've been covering up his crime for years, protecting a man whose only aim is to erase any trace of the existence of Julian Carrax, who burns his books. I also understand that you lied to me about your husband, that he's not in prison and clearly isn't here either. That's what I understand.
Nuria Montfort shook her head slowly.
Go away, Daniel. Leave this house now and don't return. You've done enough.
I walked away towards the door, leaving her in the dining room. I stopped halfway and looked back. Nuria Montfort was sitting on the floor, her back against the wall. All concern for appearances gone. I crossed the square with downcast eyes. I carried with me the pain I had received from the lips of that woman, a pain I now felt I deserved, though I didn't understand why.
You don't know what you've done, Daniel.
All I wanted was to get away from that place. As I walked past the church, I didn't at first notice the presence of a gaunt, large-nosed priest standing at the entrance, holding a missal and a rosary. He blessed me unhurriedly as I passed by. Chapter 39. I walked into the bookshop almost 45 minutes late. When my father saw me, he frowned disapprovingly and looked at the clock.
What time do you call this? You know I have got to go out to visit a client in San Cugat, and yet you left me here alone.
What about Fermin? Isn't he back yet?
My father shook his head, with that haste that seemed to take over when he was in a bad mood.
By the way, there's a letter for you. I've left it next to the till.
Dad, I'm sorry, but...
He waved my excuses aside, threw on a raincoat and hat, and went out of the door without saying goodbye. Knowing him, I guessed his anger would evaporate before he reached the train station. What I find odd was Fermin's absence. Since I'd seen him dressed up as a vaudeville priest in Plaza de San Felipe Neri, waiting for Nuria Montfort to come rushing out and lead him to the heart of a mystery, my faith in our strategy had crumbled away. I imagined that if Nuria Montfort did go out, Fermin probably ended up following her to the chemist's or the baker's. What a great plan. I went over to the till to have a look at the letter my father had mentioned. The envelope was white and rectangular, like a tombstone. and in the place of a crucifix it bore a return address that managed to crush what little spirit I had left in me that day. Military Government of Barcelona, Recruitment Office. Hallelujah, I mumbled. I knew the contents of the letter without having to open it. But even so I did, just to wallow in my misery. The letter was concise. Two paragraphs of that prose, poised somewhere between strident proclamation and the aria from an operetta that characterises all military correspondence. It was announced to me that, in 2 months' time, I, Daniel Sempere, would have the honour and pride of fulfilling the most sacred and edifying duty that could befall an Iberian male, to serve the motherland and wear the uniform of the National Crusade for the defence of the spiritual bulwark of the West. I hoped that at least Fermin would be able to see the funny side of it and make us laugh a bit with his rhyming version of the fall of the Judeo-Masonic conspiracy. 2 months, 8 weeks, 60 days. I could always divide up the time into seconds and get a number a mile long. I had 5,184,000 seconds left of freedom. Perhaps Don Federico, who according to my father could even build a Volkswagen, could make me a clock with brakes. Perhaps someone could explain to me how I was going to manage not to lose Bayer forever. When I heard the tinkle of the doorbell, I thought it would be Fermin, returning after having finally persuaded himself that our efforts as detectives were nothing more than a bad joke.
Well, if it's not the Crown Prince himself watching over his castle.
And so he should be, even if his face is as long as a cat's tail.
Cheer up, little boy blue, said Gustavo Barcelo.
He sported a camel hair coat and his customary ivory walking stick, which he didn't need and which he brandished like a cardinal's mitre.
Isn't your father in, Daniel?
I'm sorry, Don Gustavo. He went out to visit a customer, and I don't suppose he'll be back until...
Perfect.
Because it's not your father I've come to see, and it's better if he doesn't hear what I have to tell you.
He winked at me, pulling off his gloves and looking around the shop.
Where's our colleague, Fermin? Is he around?
Missing in action.
Applying his talents to the Carax case, I imagine.
Body and soul. The last time I saw him, he was wearing a cassock and was offering the benediction urbi et orbi.
I see. It's my fault for egging you on. I wish I hadn't opened my mouth.
You seem rather worried. Has anything happened?
Not exactly, or, yes, in a way.
What did you want to tell me, Don Gustavo? The bookseller smiled at me meekly. His usual haughty expression was nowhere to be seen. Instead, he looked serious and concerned.
This morning I met Don Manuel Gutierrez Fonseca. He's 59, a bachelor, and has been a city employee at the Barcelona Municipal Morgue since 1924. 30 years' service on the threshold of darkness. His words, not mine. Don Manuel is a gentleman of the old school. Courteous, pleasant, and obliging. For the last 15 years, he's been living in Calle Cenida, in a rented room that he shares with a dozen parakeets that have learned how to hum the funeral march. He has a season ticket at the Liceo. He likes Verdi and Donizetti. He told me that in his job, the important thing is to follow the rules. The rules make provisions for everything, especially for occasions when one doesn't know what to do.
15 years ago, Don Manuel opened a canvas bag brought in by the police, and in it he found his childhood best friend. The rest of the body came in a separate bag. Don Manuel, holding back his feelings, followed the rules.
Would you like a coffee, Don Gustavo? You're looking a bit pale.
Please.
I went in search of the thermos flask and poured him a cup with 8 lumps of sugar. He gulped it down. Better?
Getting there. As I was saying, the fact is that Don Manuel was on duty the day they brought the body of Julian Carax to the autopsy department in September 1936.
Of course, Don Manuel couldn't remember the name, but a look through the archives and 100 peseta donation towards his retirement fund refreshed his memory remarkably. Do you follow me?
I nodded, almost in a trance.
Don Manuel remembers all the details of that day because, as he told me, it was one of the few times when he bent the rules. The police claimed that the body had been found in an alleyway of the Raval Quarter shortly before dawn. The body reached the morgue by mid-morning. The only items on it were a book and a passport, which identified the man as Julian Fortuny Carax, born in Barcelona in 1900.
The passport had been stamped at the border post of La Junquera, showing that Carax had come into the country a month earlier. The cause of death was apparently a bullet wound. Don Manuel isn't a doctor, but over the years he has learned what to look for. In his opinion, the gunshot, just above the heart, had been delivered at point-blank range. Thanks to the passport, they were able to locate Signor Fortuny, Carax's father, who came to the morgue that very evening to identify the body.
Glad to hear it all tallies with what Nuria Montfort said. Bartholo nodded.
That's right.
What Nuria Montfort didn't tell you is that he, my friend Don Manuel, sensing that the police did not seem very interested in the case, and having realized that the book found in the pocket of the corpse bore the name of the deceased, decided to act on his own initiative and called the publishing house that very afternoon while they awaited the arrival of Fortuny.
Nuria Montfort told me that the employee at the morgue phoned the publishers 3 days later when the body had already been buried in a common grave.
According to Don Manuel, he called the same day as the body was delivered to the morgue. He tells me he spoke to a young woman who said she was grateful to him for having called.
Don Manuel remembers that he was slightly shocked by the attitude of the young lady. In his own words, it sounded as if she already knew.
What about Signor Fortuny? Is it true that he refused to identify his son?
That's what intrigued me most of all. Don Manuel tells me that at the end of the afternoon, a little man arrived, trembling, escorted by 2 policemen. It was Signor Fortuny. According to Don Manuel, that is the one thing you never get used to, the moment when those closest to the loved one come to identify the body. He says it's a situation he wouldn't wish on anyone. Worst of all, he says, is when the deceased is a young person and it's the parents or a young spouse who have to identify the body. Don Manuel remembers Signor Fortuny well. He says that when he arrived at the morgue, he could scarcely stand, that he cried like a child, and that the 2 policemen had to hold him up by his arms. He kept moaning, "What have they done to my son? What have they done to my son?"
Did he get to see the body?
Don Manuel told me that he was on the point of asking the police officers whether they might skip the normal procedure. It's the only time it occurred to him to question the rules. The corpse was in a bad state. It had probably been dead for over 24 hours when it reached the morgue. And not since dawn that day, as the police claimed. Manuel was afraid that when that little old man saw it, he would break down. Signor Fortuny kept on repeating that it couldn't be, that his Julian couldn't be dead. Then Don Manuel removed the shroud that covered the body and the 2 policemen asked Fortuny formally whether this was his son, Julian. And? Signor Fortuny was dumbfounded. He stared at the body for almost a minute. Then he turned on his heels and left.
He left?
In a hurry.
What about the police? Didn't they stop him? Wasn't he supposed to be there to identify the body?
Bartholo smiled roguishly. In theory, but Don Manuel remembers there was someone else in the room. A 3rd policeman who had come in quietly while the other 2 were preparing Signor Fortuny. He was watching the scene without saying a word, leaning against the wall with a cigarette in his mouth. Don Manuel remembers him because, when he told him that the regulations strictly forbade smoking in the morgue, one of the officers signalled to him to be quiet.
According to Don Manuel, as soon as Signor Fortuny had left, the third policeman went up to the body, glanced at it, and spat on its face. Then he kept the passport and gave orders for the body to be sent to Montjuic, to be buried in a common grave at daybreak.
It doesn't make sense.
That's what Don Manuel thought, especially as none of it tallied with the rules. But we don't know who this man is, he said. The two other policemen didn't reply. Don Manuel rebuked them angrily. Or do you know only too well, because it is quite clear to us all that he's been dead for at least a day? Don Manuel was obviously referring to the regulations and was no fool. According to him, when the third policeman heard his protests, he went up to him, looked him straight in the eye, and asked him whether he cared to join the deceased on his last voyage. Don Manuel was terrified. The man had the eyes of a lunatic, and Don Manuel didn't doubt for one moment that he meant what he said. He mumbled that he was only trying to comply with the regulations, that nobody knew who the man was, and that, consequently, he couldn't be buried yet. This man is whoever I say he is, answered the policeman. Then he picked up the registration form and signed it, closing the case. Don Manuel says he'll never forget that signature, because during the war years, and for a long time afterwards, he would come across it on dozens of death certificates for bodies that arrived from goodness knows where, bodies that nobody managed to identify.
Inspector Francisco Javier Fumero.
The pride and glory of Central Police Headquarters. Do you realize what this means, Daniel?
That we've been lashing out blindly from the very beginning?
Bartholomew took his hat and stick and walked over to the door, tut-tutting under his breath. No.
It means the lashings are about to start now.
Chapter 40. I spent the afternoon surveying the grim letter announcing my draft, hoping for signs of life from Fermin. Half an hour after our closing time, Fermin's whereabouts remained unknown. I picked up the telephone and called the pension in Calle Joaquin Costa. Doña Encarna answered, her voice thick with alcohol. She said she hadn't seen Fermin since that morning.
If he's not back within the next half hour, he'll have to have his supper cold. This isn't the Ritz, you know. I hope nothing's happened to him.
Don't worry, Doña Encarna. He had some errand to do and must have been delayed. In any case, if you do see him before going to bed, I'd be very grateful if you could ask him to call me. It's Daniel Semperi, your friend Methodita's his neighbour.
Of course, but I must warn you that I turned in for the night at 8:30.
After that, I phoned Bartholo's home, hoping that Fermin might have turned up there to empty Bernarda's larder or carry her off into the ironing room. It hadn't occurred to me that Clara might answer the phone.
Daniel, what a surprise!
You stole my line, I thought.
Talking to her in a roundabout manner worthy of Don Anacleto, the schoolteacher, I let drop the reason for my call, but in a very casual manner, almost in passing.
No, Fermin hasn't come by all day, and Bernarda has been with me all afternoon, so I would know. Actually, we've been talking about you.
What a boring conversation.
Bernarda says you look very handsome, quite grown up.
I take a lot of vitamins.
A long silence.
Daniel, do you think we could be friends again some day? How many years will it take you to forgive me?
We are friends already, Clara. And I don't need to forgive you for anything, you know that.
My uncle says you're still investigating Julian Carax. Why don't you come by some afternoon for tea and tell me the latest? I've also got things to tell you.
One of these days, I promise.
I'm getting married, Daniel.
I stared at the receiver. I felt as if my feet were sinking into the ground or I had shrunk a few inches.
Daniel, are you there?
Yes.
You're surprised.
I swallowed. My mouth felt like concrete.
No.
What surprises me is that you're not already married. You can't have lacked suitors.
Who's the lucky man?
You don't know him. His name is Jacobo. He's a friend of Uncle Gustavo, a director of the Bank of Spain. We met at an opera recital organised by my uncle. Jacobo's enthusiastic about opera. He's older than me, but we're very good friends, and that's what matters, don't you think?
My mouth was full of malice, so I bit my tongue. It tasted like poison.
Of course. So, listen, congratulations.
You'll never forgive me, will you, Daniel? For you, I'll always be the perfidious Clara Bartholo.
To me, you'll always be Clara Bartholo, period. And you know that as well as I do.
There was another silence, the kind in which grey hairs seem to creep up on you.
What about you, Daniel? Fermin tells me you have a beautiful girlfriend.
I've got to go, Clara. A client has just come in. I'll call you one of these days and we'll meet for tea. Congratulations once again.
I put down the phone and sighed.
My father returned from his visit to the client, looking dejected and not in the mood for conversation. He got dinner ready while I set the table, without even asking after Fermin or how the day had gone in the bookshop. We stared at our plates during the meal, hiding behind the chatter of the news on the radio. My father hardly ate. He just stirred the watery, tasteless soup with his spoon, as if he were looking for gold in the bottom.
"You haven't touched your food," I said.
My father shrugged his shoulders. The radio continued to bombard us with nonsense. My father got up and turned it off.
"What did the letter from the army say?" he asked finally.
"I have to join up in 2 months' time." His face seemed to age by 10 years.
"Bartholo says he'll try to pull some strings so that I can be transferred to the military government in Barcelona after the initial training. I'll even be able to come home to sleep," I added.
My father replied with an anemic nod. I found it painful to hold his gaze, so I got up to clear the table. My father remained seated, his eyes lost and his hands clasped under his chin. I was about to wash up the dishes when I heard footsteps pounding up the stairs. Firm, hurried footsteps that spoke a terrible warning. I looked up and exchanged glances with my father. The footsteps stopped on our landing. My father stood up, looking anxious. A second later we heard banging on the door and a furious booming voice that sounded vaguely familiar.
"Police, open up!"
1,000 daggers stabbed at my mind. Another volley of banging made the door shake. My father walked up to the door and lifted the cover of the peephole.
"What do you want at this time of night?"
"Open the door, we'll kick it down, Semperi. Don't make me have to repeat myself."
I recognised the voice as Fumero's, and my heart turned to ice. My father threw me a questioning look. I nodded. Suppressing a sigh, he opened the door. Fumero and his two henchmen were silhouetted against the yellowish light of the landing, ashen-faced puppets in grey raincoats.
"Where is he?"
shouted Fumero, swiping my father aside and pushing his way into the dining room. My father tried to stop him, but one of the policemen who was covering the inspector's back grabbed him by the arm and pushed him against the wall, holding him with the coldness and efficiency of a man accustomed to the task. It was the same man who had followed Fermin and myself, the same one who had held me while Fumero beat up my friend outside the hospice of Santa Lucia, the same one who had kept watch on me a couple of nights before. He shot me an empty, deadpan look. I went up to Fumero, displaying all the calm I could muster. The inspector's eyes were bloodshot. A recent scratch ran down his left cheek, edged with dry blood.
"Where?"
"Where what?" Fumero looked down suddenly and shook his head, mumbling to himself. When he raised his face, he had a wolfish grimace on his lips and a revolver in his hand. Without taking his eyes off mine, he banged the butt of his revolver against the vase of withered flowers on the table. The vase smashed into small fragments, spilling the water and shriveled stalks over the tablecloth. Despite myself, I shivered. My father was shouting from the entrance hall, held firmly in the grip of the two policemen. I could barely decipher his words. All I could absorb was the icy pressure of the gun's barrel sunk into my cheek and the smell of gunpowder.
Don't fuck with me, you little shit, or your father will have to pick up your brains off the floor. Do you hear me?
I nodded. I was shaking. Fumero pressed the barrel hard against my cheek. I could feel it cutting into my skin, but I didn't even dare blink.
This is the last time I'll ask you. Where is he?
I saw myself reflected in the black pupils of the inspector's eyes. They slowly contracted as he tightened the hammer with his thumb.
Not here. I haven't seen him since lunchtime. It's the truth.
Fumero stood still for almost half a minute, digging the gun into my face and smacking his lips.
Lerma, he ordered, take a look around.
One of the policemen hurried off to inspect the apartment. My father struggled in vain with the third officer.
If you've lied to me, and we find him in this house, I swear I'll break both your father's legs, whispered Fumero.
My father doesn't know anything. Leave him alone.
You're the one who doesn't know what he's playing at.
But as soon as I get hold of your friend, the game's over. No judges, no hospitals, no fucking nothing. This time I'll personally see to it that he's put out of circulation.
And I'm going to enjoy doing it, believe me. I'm going to take my time. You can tell him if you see him, because I'm going to find him, even if I have to turn over every stone in the city. And you're next on the list.
The officer called Lerma reappeared in the dining room and gave a slight shake of his head. Fumero loosened his grip on the hammer and removed the revolver.
Pity, said Fumero.
What has he done? Why are you looking for him?
Fumero turned his back on me and went up to the policeman, who, at his signal, let go of my father.
You're going to remember this, spat my father.
Fumero's eyes rested on his. Instinctively, my father took a step back. I feared that Inspector Fumero's visit had only just begun, but suddenly the man shook his head, laughing under his breath, and left the apartment. Lerma followed him. The third policeman, my sentinel, paused for a moment in the doorway. He looked silently at me, as if he wanted to say something.
Palacios!
Yelled Fumero, his voice fading into the echo of the stairwell. Palacios lowered his eyes and disappeared round the door. I went out to the landing. I could see the blades of light emerging from the half-open doors of the neighbours, their frightened faces peeping out in the dark. The three shadowy shapes of the policemen vanished down the stairs, and the angry sound of their footsteps receded like a poisoned tide, leaving behind it a residue of fear. It was about midnight when we heard more banging on the door, this time weaker, almost fearful. My father, who was dabbing iodine on the bruise left on my cheek by Fumero's gun, stopped in his tracks. Our eyes met. There were three more knocks. For a moment I thought it was Fermin, who had perhaps witnessed the whole incident hidden in some dark corner of the staircase.
Who's there?
Asked my father.
Don Anacleto, Signor Sempere.
My father gave out a sigh. We opened the door to find the teacher looking paler than ever.
Don Anacleto, what's the matter? Are you all right?
My father asked, letting him in. The teacher was holding a folded newspaper. He handed it to us with a horrified look. The paper was still warm, the ink still damp.
It's tomorrow's edition, murmured Don Anacleto. Page 6?
What first caught my eye were the two photographs under the heading. The first was a picture of Fermin, with a fuller figure and more hair, perhaps 15 or 20 years younger. The second showed the face of a woman, with her eyes closed and skin like marble. It took me a few seconds to recognize her, because I was used to seeing her in the half-light.
Tramp murders woman in broad daylight, Barcelona press agency. Police are looking for the tramp who stabbed a woman to death this afternoon. Her name was Núria Monfort Masdedeu, and she lived in Barcelona. The crime took place in mid-afternoon in the neighbourhood of San Gervasio,
where the victim was assaulted by the tramp with no apparent motive. According to Central Police Headquarters, it would appear that the tramp had been following her for reasons that have not yet been made clear. It seems that the murderer, 55-year-old Antonio José Gutiérrez Alcayete, from Villa Inmunda in the province of Cáceres, is a well-known criminal with a long record of mental illness, who escaped from La Modelo prison 6 years ago and has managed to elude the authorities by assuming different identities. At the time of the murder, he was dressed in a cassock. He is armed, and the police describe him as highly dangerous. It is not yet known whether the victim and her murderer knew one another, although sources from police headquarters indicate that everything points towards this. Nor is it known what may have been the motive behind the crime. The victim was stabbed 6 times in her stomach, chest and throat. The attack, which took place close to a school, was witnessed by a number of pupils, who alerted the teachers. They in turn called the police and an ambulance. According to the police report, death was caused by multiple wounds. The victim was pronounced dead on arrival at Barcelona's Hospital Clínico at 18:15.